First case on our calendar, 08-128, City of Lima, Ohio versus the State of Ohio. Mr. Meiser.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Ben Meiser for the State of Ohio. If I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The statute at issue in these cases, Ohio's freedom of residency law, is constitutional for two independent reasons. First, the General Assembly enacted the law under Article 2, Section 34 of the Ohio Constitution, and as all parties to these cases agree, valid Section 34 legislation trumps other limitations on the General Assembly's authority. Second, even if Section 34 doesn't apply, the Home Rule Amendment does not protect local residency restrictions because those restrictions implicate significant statewide concerns. Therefore, the General Assembly acted wholly within its constitutional authority when it moved to protect the ability of public employees to live where they choose.
Mr. Geiger, if I could stop you for a moment there, you had stated there was no dispute whatsoever that this particular section trumped other portions of the Constitution. I believe there was something in the briefs that would dispute that, wasn't there?
The parties agree that, as this court held in Rocky River 4, the Section 34 trumps the home rule provision of the Constitution. The parties don't all agree about other provisions of the Constitution, but specifically about the ability of Section 34 to trump the Home Rule Amendment. At least that's my understanding from the briefs and certainly what was conceded in the courts below.
Well, we'll see if what counsel
right.
has to say about that.
Right.
Thank you.
In any event, the analysis does begin with Section 34 because, as this court held in Rocky River 4, the Home Rule Amendment doesn't trump Section 34 enactments because Section 34 contains a supremacy clause that provides that no other provision of the Constitution shall impair or limit the power conferred by Section 34. And Section 34 authorizes the General Assembly to provide for the comfort, health, safety, and general welfare of employees. This court's holding—
How does the statute here affect the general welfare of the employees?
It does so, Your Honor, because it relates substantially to the relationship between employer and employee and to the employment relationship.
But it doesn't do anything with respect to their working conditions, does it?
It does not relate specifically to working conditions, nor does it have to under Section 34. This court's holding in Rocky River 4 said that Section 34 is not limited to the workplace, but instead is about the general welfare of employees. And in that case, this court specifically was dealing with the Collective Bargaining Act. The Collective Bargaining Act is about the relationship between employer and employee with respect to terms and conditions of employment. That is what this case is squarely about, terms and conditions of employment.
But Mr. Geiger, it's not about all employees, is it? I mean, you're relying solely on, or it seems like you're really relying on Rocky River 4 for your position. But if you look at the Constitution, it doesn't say all employees. I mean, it doesn't say employees, it says all employees. So as the Chief Justice just suggested, are we talking about a law that is affecting all employees and their general health, safety, and welfare?
We are not, Your Honor, nor does this court's case law interpreting Section 34 require valid Section 34 legislation to relate to all employees. In AAUP and in Rocky River 4, this court considered statutory provisions that related only to public employees. AAUP provides a perfect example because there, the General Assembly was regulating only with respect to professors at public universities, but the all employees phrase did not place that legislation outside of the authority of Section 34. And the General Assembly could, this court held, under Section 34, enact legislation that related only to a certain segment of public employment.
And Mr. Meiser, I apologize for giving you the wrong name, but the Rocky River 4 case, it was rather a splintered opinion, was it not? And it was a reconsideration of a previous decision. Would you say that if we were to find against you that we would have to reverse, or we would have to invalidate Rocky River 4?
Yes. In order to strike this legislation down, this court would not only have to reverse Rocky River 4, but also AAUP and the pension fund case. All three of those cases considered legislation very much like this, that dealt with the terms and conditions. Well, pension fund wasn't so much about terms and conditions of employment, but instead it was legislation dealing with the employer-employee relationship that did not relate specifically to workplace conditions or to the workplace environment, but instead dealt more broadly with the welfare of employees with respect.
Collective bargaining usually deals with workplace conditions, does it not? Hours and safety issues, all the things that are in collective bargaining. It doesn't do with, they don't usually deal with residency in collective bargaining agreements. Are there any collective bargaining agreements in which residency of the employees is addressed?
Yes, and there's an amicus. I can't remember, Your Honor, who the amicus is, but there is an amicus who submitted evidence of collective bargaining agreements that do deal with residency restrictions. And under Chapter 4117, residency, if it's not dealt with by a local or state law prior to the enactment of the law at issue here, could have been the subject of collective bargaining. And indeed, it would have been a mandatory subject of collective bargaining, as one of the appellate courts held in St. Bernard's. And the reason it was a mandatory subject of bargaining is because it is a critical term and condition of employment. And terms and conditions of employment are mandatory terms of collective bargaining under 4117. Therefore, this case, as dealing with something that would be a mandatory term of collective bargaining were it not for the laws at issue, both locally and at the state level, by dealing with a mandatory term of collective bargaining, this law falls squarely within the rubric of Rocky River 4, which said that collective bargaining is a proper subject for an enactment under Section 34.
If we were to find in your favor and find that this is a 34 subject and they have the state has the ability to regulate, what happens to collective bargaining agreements that may differ from the state statute?
That would have to be the subject of another case, but I think the best reading of Section 34 is that those terms in collective bargaining agreements would no longer be valid, because 4117 says that that terms dealing with residency are trumped by terms of laws dealing with residency, and this law deals with residency and would therefore trump those collective bargaining agreements.
Counsel, is the does this whole case turn on the reach of Section 30 or Section 34 of Article 2? And if we don't agree that the reach is broad enough to allow this kind of legislation to come in under that umbrella, is the case over for your side, or is there a fallback position in the Canton cases?
No, the case doesn't end with Section 34, Your Honor. There is a fallback argument that supports the legislation, and that is the statewide concerns doctrine. This court has repeatedly held that when a municipality purports to regulate an issue of local self-government, this court looks at whether or not that actually is a bona fide issue of local self-government. And as this court explained in Beechwood, local self-government means matters of purely internal affairs, governmental and administrative internal affairs. And under the statewide concern doctrine, as articulated by this court in cases like Redding and Kettering, the court looks at whether or not the purported matter of local self-government has extraterritorial effects and reaches an issue of statewide concern. This case does relate to the local residency restrictions at issue in this case do have extraterritorial effects. And in fact, those extraterritorial effects are demonstrated by the city's own evidence. The city of Akron, in the case that will follow this one, and the city of Lima itself has introduced evidence that they will be affected if they are forced to lift their residency bans. They will lose property values, they will lose residents, they will lose school funding. Those demonstrated effects, if their evidence is correct, then what they have demonstrated is that there are extraterritorial effects, because the lifting of the residency bans will cause the surrounding territory to be affected by the movement of people and money. And the General Assembly, as this court explained very clearly in Beechwood, may act where a matter that purports to be one of internal affairs actually has significant extraterritorial effects.
Counsel, the General Assembly also cited Section 1 of Article 1, the Bill of Rights of the state, as a basis for the legislation, and the Bill of Rights basically talks about fundamental rights. I don't see that discussed much by the courts below.
No, Your Honor, the state does not maintain that a fundamental right is at stake here in a way that trumps the local residency restrictions. This court and various federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court, have held that that having a job and being able to live where you want is not a fundamental right on the constitutional level. But still, the General Assembly recognized that this is an issue that affects the welfare of Ohio citizens. The General Assembly had a great deal of testimony in front of it, and that's available in the record. That testimony showed that this affects the lives of everyday citizens. If a spouse works for the city of Akron, the other spouse works for the city of Canton, and if both of those cities have residency restrictions, that household cannot live together and hold their jobs, because one has to live in Canton and the other has to live in Akron. Or as one amicus in front of this court, Mr. Burdishaw, testified, he works for the city of Akron. His family, his estranged spouse, and his four children live in Massillon, and he cannot be near his children because he has to live within the city of Akron. So this is affecting the lives of people. So it may not rise to the level of a constitutional right, Your Honor, but it does implicate the lives of citizens in a way that the General Assembly surely was authorized to reach, either under the statewide concerns doctrine or under the power of Section 34.
But isn't that argument, can't that argument be raised by anyone who seeks to be employed someplace? There are conditions on any employment, virtually any employment, I guess. And so the fact that one has to live in the city in which they are employed as a firefighter or a police officer or safety officer, what right is being violated here?
Again, Your Honor, it's not a constitutional right necessarily that's being violated, but as this court has observed, the public employment sector is the largest employment sector in this state, and the General Assembly justifiably was concerned about the significant family concerns being presented to it in the legislative record, and it was able to act to rectify those concerns either under one of its two sources of authority, Section 34 or the statewide concerns doctrine.
Do you wish to speak to the safety concerns that the practical safety concerns that I would identify that raised by opposing counsel, that is that the necessity for safety officers and persons who do all sorts of things, plow roads, and you know the argument, that they need to live not 60 miles away, as one example was given. What's your response to that argument?
My response is twofold, Your Honor. First, the General Assembly had in the legislative record testimony stating that no city that did not have a residency restriction had any complaints or problems with response times by safety forces. Second, the response times by safety forces concerns raised by the cities in this case are not relevant to the inquiry under Section 34, because if the question is whether or not this is a term and condition of employment that the General Assembly can regulate, then the city's concerns aren't relevant to the power of the General Assembly. And third, the statute does contain a safety valve. If a locality is concerned about response times, the statute provides a measure, a mechanism by which the locality can require their employees to live within a one-county radius. I see that my time is nearly out, so I will defer to the City of Lima and save my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Miser. Mr. Geiger.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. My name is Tony Geiger. I'm representing the City of Lima. With me at council table is counsel for Amicus Curiae City of Cleveland, Mr. Robert Triazzi on my far right, and Mr. Gary Singletary in the center. Your Honors, the city takes the position in this case that Section 9.481 is not validly enacted under Article 2, Section 34. Justice Pfeiffer, you ask if the issue boils down to the reach of Section 34. And we think it does. And we think that this statute goes beyond the reach of Section 34. The lower court, in trying to establish that reach, concluded that for the statute to be valid, there has to be some nexus between the ends of the statute and the working environment, the working conditions. And in that regard, the city distinguishes, thinks there's a distinction between conditions of employment and conditions for employment. We believe residency, in essence, is a qualification. It's a condition for employment. It's not a condition of employment in terms of the workplace environment, whether it's too hot, too cold, whether the machines are safe, those types.
Well, counsel, in that regard, your mayor, his testimony is cited in the Court of Appeals opinion, and he listed a number of impacts on the city of, a number of reasons why it's important to the city of Lima to have this requirement, including the interest of the employees in the well-being of their own city, where they live, and those kinds of things. And also refers to maintaining a racially balanced workforce that reflects the city. Would it be possible, if this legislation is deemed to be valid, to still have a requirement that you must live in the city in order to get through the first interview process, in other words, to get hired, or to have some mechanism that rewards residents in the city in terms of the pecking order if there are tests in order to get hired for certain jobs, or is that all out the window as well with this legislation? In other words, not requiring them, once you're hired on, to necessarily live there, but to get a leg up, so to speak, in the process of being hired. Would it be possible for Lima to have that as a requirement if this legislation was valid?
Your Honor, I believe that this legislation would prohibit that requirement because the day that the person became an employee, those preconditions would cease to have any validity. So in essence, it would become meaningless to require that, because the goal, residency, would be eliminated beginning on day one. So no, I don't believe it would withstand.
Counsel, I have a question about the third district's opinion on paragraph 26. They recite the Article 2, Section 34. And it's my understanding, based on what follows, that they would have the provision providing for the comfort, health, safety, and general welfare of all employees to be interpreted that means all employees in their work environment, as opposed to all employees as a liberally construed and all-encompassing definition or interpretation. Would that be an accurate reading of the third district?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it would.
Then I have a question about their paragraph 40, where they're talking about the legislative history and going back to the 1912 Constitution and what had transpired. And in section 40, they discuss a response from a fellow named Mr. Dwyer, who makes a statement that we should put a clause in the Constitution that will give the courts an opportunity to more liberally construe these matters. And they're talking about employees' rights and benefits, more liberally construe these matters than they have done in the past. How do those two statements reconcile?
Your Honor, I think the latter still falls within the framework of the work environment, that it does not go, even though it's more liberal, beyond wages, for example, and hours, and it encompasses general welfare of employees, that the Third District's opinion was that that still has to fall within the scope of employment. And so the two, in essence, are consistent because they still try to relate to the employment situation, the on-the-job employment situation. The court, in trying to...
Well, then, counsel, if you read on in these discussions, and again, I'm only citing this because the Third District relied heavily on the 1912 convention for the Constitution readings, and if you go to page 19, another statement by Mr. Dwyer states that employers should make his life, meaning the life of the employee, as pleasant for him as you can, consistent with his employment. And again, one would think when you're talking about his life, it would not just be the 8 hours or 10 hours that was addressed, would be addressed by the employment situation. I just find an inconsistency in their narrowing of the interpretation, inserting the words in the Constitution, Section 34, and then relying on the history behind the 1912 Constitution to make a point where I think what they've cited argues against it.
Your Honor, with respect, I would direct your attention to that last phrase, consistent with his employment. I think that draws the scope back into the employment environment, which is what the first two clauses of Section 34 deal with. The hours clause, the minimum wage clause, they deal with the condition of employment, the wages and hours and the terms and conditions of employment.
And but that's if the condition of employment is that they're limited in the scope of where they can live and where their families can live, and this is not a palatable position to be placed in, is that making their life as pleasant as you can, consistent with employment? And I'm not saying that the Constitution, you know, background is controlling here. I'm just trying to understand the rationale of the Third District.
Your Honor, I think the basis of the Third District's opinion and the city's position is that residency is not a condition of employment within the working environment, the day-to-day working environment. And I tried to make the distinction earlier between a condition of employment and a condition for employment. It's a condition to enable the person to be hired. It's a pre-employment qualification, if you will. Well,
what does that qualification have to do with the life of a fireman, for example, who reports to a firehouse and stays there to respond to an emergency? And from that point, handles whatever emergencies might arise during that term of employment. What is the rational connection between that individual's residence and the performance, as you say, a condition of employment?
Your Honor, for the cities, it creates, if you will, an intangible quality.
Pardon me?
It creates, if you will, an intangible quality within that employee that because they live in the city, there's a greater likelihood they will be more responsive to the city's governmental concerns. They will...
Something that transcends their employment.
Yes, yes. And so whether it's a good idea to have residency certainly is a matter of fair debate. But when you're talking about the decision what employees to hire and what qualifications they should have, that's a matter that should be left to the local entities, not the state.
Well, but the argument is, I think, that if I understood Mr. Miser's position, it transcends the territorial confines of one city and materially affects an adjoining city or another community. So it isn't just a matter of local self-government, I think his position is. It's something beyond that. He said statewide concern.
Yes, and Your Honor, we respectfully disagree. The issue of a house located outside the city limits, if that house is not purchased by a City of Lima employee, what evidence is there that that house would not be purchased by someone else? It's a fallacy to argue that just because the city employee didn't buy the house or the city's employees' children didn't go to that school district, that someone else would not. There's simply no evidence in the record to substantiate
that. That argument is reflecting on your own position, however. Same thing applies to a city within the city of, to a home within the city of Lima.
Exactly, Your Honor. It does apply. And that's the reason that the viewpoint the city has that I tried to articulate earlier is that it's an intangible quality. Of course, we get benefit from the person buying the house inside the city. But that's not the only reason we want them in there, because somebody else obviously could buy that house as well. So that's why I try to focus more on the intangible qualities that an employee who lives inside the city brings to the city.
Council, is there any data, and I don't know that this is even dispositive of what we're talking about here, but out of curiosity, is there any data that a firefighter living outside of the city responds differently than one who lives within the city?
Your Honor, there is no data for the City of Lima that I'm aware of,
but just
other than
generally.
I apologize. In general, there certainly is the geographic reality that in the event that a firefighter has to be called in to respond to an emergency, where they live, the geographical reality means it's going to take a certain amount of time. And if they're outside the city, a county away from the city, it's going to take longer than if they were inside the city. Your Honors, I would like to allow amicus to finish up the remaining
time.
Thank
you, Mr. Geiger. Mr. Singletary.
Thank you. Justices, the City of Cleveland comes before you today to argue as an amicus the point that if you look, you raised the Rocky River 4 decision earlier. We believe the more important case to look at in the context of the residency laws is the Foldauer case, which came out of this court back in 1972. In that case, the court held that in the absence of conflict with general law, Article 2, Section 34 would have no application to Cleveland's exercise of local self-government. Now, in the context of the Rocky River 4 decision, Justice Douglas recognized before he began his analysis, as did the court back in Kettering, the FOP Dayton decision back in the mid-80s, this court recognized that the Collective Bargaining Act itself was an exercise of the state's police power. In that regard, the state passed collective bargaining for the purpose of protecting the citizens of the state of Ohio from such things as police strikes, doctors, nurses strikes, things of that nature.
Council, you have a lot of laws that are statewide governing pensions, governing health benefits of retired people, governing ethics of anyone who's employed by the state or by cities. How do we rationalize those as statewide laws in light of your argument that the city can trump it? That's a condition for employment, and those are not acts that affect someone on the job, they're acts that affect them after they've retired or in their private life, if they're a state employee, if it's an ethics law.
Your Honor, I believe that if you look at those particular kinds of actions by the state, they address something that is a vested benefit in that individual. If you look at the pension fund case back in 1967, this state had a history of regulations addressing the pension fund that had accumulated over the years. The court's decision in 1967 only transferred monies with respect to locals into a state-administered fund, but it recognizes, I believe, that the court was protecting the vested rights of those who had accumulated monies or benefits arising out of their employment. If you look at this court in the Buckley decision in 1980, there is no vested right to demand employment with a city at the same time you demand the right to live outside that city. There simply is no constitutional right, and the legislature's reliance on Article 1 for the purpose of protecting what they consider a fundamental right just does not arise, because there is no such right if you want employment with the city.
Counsel, if we conclude that the reach of Section 34 is not broad enough to encompass this legislation, you still have an enactment of the General Assembly that conflicts with local ordinances. So what's your best case if you get us past the first hurdle? There is the second hurdle. The statute's still there. So what's your best case to say that we should declare the enactment unconstitutional, irrespective of 34, assuming you've gotten us across that hurdle, there's the second fence.
Well, Your Honor, I believe if you get past the 34 argument, which I believe you should, then the next step would be, is this a matter under the Canton test? Is this a general law? Is there a conflict? And if so, is any statewide concern actually raised in this case? This court has ruled on numerous occasions that the appointment of officers in the police force, for example, is a matter of local self-government. You have to divide local self-government from the exercise of the police authority. Now, in this particular case, the exercise of local self-government in the appointment and the qualifications you put on those appointments is not subject to regulation by the state's police authority, which in effect they're attempting to accomplish here, because it's pure local self-government. If you look at your analysis in the American Financial Services Act, and as was more recently interpreted in the Mendenhall Act, the Mendenhall decision, you're looking at whether there is a conflict, but also whether it's a police matter or local self-government.
If it's do we look at something as recent as the Clyde case involving guns? Justice O'Donnell undertook a heroic effort some time back to make some consistent sense of all of our cases regarding home rule. I think in the end he concluded it was a pretty tough chore, that depending on what the issue of the day was, you can find cases going both ways in interpreting whether or not home rule trumps an enactment of the General Assembly.
But I believe Justice O'Donnell's bottom line in the decision adopted by this court was that if it is a matter of local self-government, the analysis stops. And there's nothing more pure local self-government than who makes up the employment force for a particular city. The state is allowed to use 234 and to use its police power to regulate who works for a city, then local self-government is going to evaporate, and it's a right that arises out of the Constitution itself. The cities are no longer subject to control, or their authority does not arise through the General Assembly. This is not a police power issue, and I know my time is up, Your Honor.
Let me ask you that, because you said we should apply the Canton test, and there's some in the briefing, and of course the Court of Appeals applies Canton test, but that isn't the Canton test applied only if the city has exercised its police power?
You're right, Your Honor, and I would say you
Canton
don't.
Canton really is not, because I think all council agree that this is this exercise of governmental authority, right?
That's correct, and the state.
Akron and Lima both exercise governmental authority. But isn't this, so you would argue we should not apply the Canton test?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that you use Canton to the effect that when you reach, like in Mendenhall, the first question to be asked mm-hmm. is whether it's an exercise of the police authority or whether it's an exercise of local self-government. In this case, it's clearly local self-government, and the Canton test is cut off from that
point.
Isn't
the second step, though, that you said if it's local self-government, that's the end of it, but I don't think that is it? Don't we, isn't the next question whether the ordinance has the impact or has the effect of having an impact on the general population be far beyond its, as in Cleveland Electric illuminating, even if there is a matter of local concern about if the regulation subject matter affects the general public of the state as a whole more than it does the local inhabitants, the matter passes from what was a matter of local self-government to a matter of state interest. Now, maybe that's from the Municipal League's brief, and maybe that's been overruled by us. We have so many cases, as Justice Piper said, this is an area in which every case seems to have a different test applied to it.
Your Honor, in that particular case, the CEI case dealing with the local regulation of transmission lines that are running through a locality, that clearly is an exercise relating to the public good per se.
The case helps you, doesn't it? Seems to me.
I would say it
because
does help us because
they're arguing that, well, it has an effect on somebody who lives next door right over the city line, but that's not a general impact on the general population, I don't think, is it?
I would argue not, Your Honor, because it's been pointed out in several briefs that there are 134 villages and cities across Ohio that have some kind of residency law. Some are more restrictive, some are apply to fewer employees. There's even state laws that apply to certain officials. If the exercise of a city or a village of its local self-governing rights that arise under the Constitution is viewed as a statewide concern because of the number of cities that exercise that right, then there is no local self-government. That is not a statewide concern.
Well, Council, could it be looked at that this requirement that only residents of one of these 134 villages or cities are eligible for employment, doesn't that impact all of the other individuals who would be qualified for employment as firefighters, paramedics, police, street crew, whatever, that can't apply for those jobs or cannot avail themselves of that type of employment, which is a considerable number of people, outside of these 134? And is that not a statewide concern?
It's certainly not a statewide concern that was expressed with the passage of this particular bill. I think you have to go back to the way this court recognized residency in the Buckley case back in 1980. It's simply that if you want to work for the city, you have to respect the laws of the city with regards to employment. In Cleveland's case, Charter Provision 74 arises through a vote of the electorate. A charter is adopted by the people of Cleveland. As this court recognizes, that's the constitution, in effect, of our city. And in that regard, the city of Cleveland, the voters therein say, if you want to work for us, the city of Cleveland, get a paycheck from the city of Cleveland, then you can live in the city of Cleveland. Everyone, police, firefighters, and others recognize that fact, and there's never any shortage of applicants for those particular jobs. And I don't think, certainly there's no evidence that firefighters and policemen over the 60, 70 years that we've had residency, that the city is not providing adequate or great services in that regard.
But the impact that I think Mr. Miser was talking about on a statewide concern is if those employees suddenly gravitate to other communities for their residence, doesn't that impact those other communities? And then when you multiply it by the 160 villages or cities or municipalities across the state, doesn't that itself create a statewide impact?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that this court, when it looks at extraterritoriality, is, if you look at the Columbus Teeter case, is the city actually trying to regulate outside of its boundaries where state law forbids it to do so? In this case, the city, again, is operating under its constitutional authority, local self-government. There's probably a variety of laws that I can't enumerate here that would have some extraterritorial effect, but I think what you should be looking at is the regulation itself. The city's regulating within its boundaries its own workforce.
Council, would you give greater weight to an ordinance that was passed by the electorate than one that is passed by the council, city council?
No. I believe that a charter provision is viewed as somewhat above an ordinance with regards to the strength of the provision, but I believe that any charter city operates pursuant to its charter. In the case of Lima, the authority would flow to its city council, and I would believe that a charter city would have the same rights, whether the residency law flows through its council or through an election by the voters of the city.
So the court should look at each situation equally, not pay attention to how the ordinance or the charter provision came about by the electorate vote or the vote of a limited council.
I believe for a charter city that would be correct, Your Honor. There may be differences for a non-charter city, but with respect to living within its charter, whether it's a vote by the people or the council, it's part of the governing charter.
Thank you, Mr. Singletary.
Thank you.
Mr. Miser, you've saved us a little less than a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, on the statewide concern doctrine, I would point this court to the Evans case, which squarely rebuts much of what the city of Cleveland has argued with respect to the statewide concern doctrine. The Evans case was about a prevailing wage law enacted by the city of Upper Arlington, just up 315 from here. That local enactment was purely a matter of the wages paid within the city of Upper Arlington. Upper Arlington wasn't trying to regulate wages paid in a nearby town or city. And this court said that that prevailing wage law was trumped by the state prevailing wage law because prevailing wage was properly a matter of statewide concern within the authority of the General Assembly to regulate. So the question under statewide concern is not whether or not the city is trying to regulate other cities. It's whether or not the city is regulating something that has effects beyond its boundaries on a matter of statewide concern. Moreover, on Section 34 and the conditions of employment, the city of Lima here has conceded that the condition of employment imposed with respect to public employees' residence is a matter that transcends employment, that it's central to what the city requires of its employees, and it's central to the employer-employee relationship. That's precisely what makes it fall within the power of the General Assembly to regulate under Section 34 as a matter of employment.
Mr. Miser, if we find that one of the reasons or a reason that the General Assembly has asserted for adopting a statute, we find that that's in error or that it doesn't apply, what effect does that have on our decision whether the statute is constitutional or not?
Well, if one of the purported bases of the law is invalid, then that might not be a proper basis for regulating. But this law is supported by multiple bases for regulating. For one thing, the General Assembly had before it a voluminous record relating to the effects that local residency restrictions have, first on the employer-employee relationship and the lives and the general welfare of employees, and second, on the territories surrounding this city that has imposed a residency restriction. 125 cities and an additional 13 villages have local residency restrictions. Taken together, all of those residency restrictions have a tremendous effect on the many, many public sector employees in this state and their ability to live where they choose, their ability to live with their families. and the relationship that they have with their employer. The General Assembly therefore had before it a great deal of evidence on which to exercise not only its ability under Section 34 to regulate employment, but also its ability to...
But the number of, there has to be some, the fact that a number of cities, 135 cities or governments do this doesn't mean it's wrong, does it?
It certainly doesn't mean it's wrong, Your Honor. But what it does mean is that the General Assembly had evidence of the fact that taken together, all of those restrictions had substantial effects on statewide employment, and therefore the General Assembly was able to regulate it, not because it was wrong, but because it fell within the statewide concern doctrine. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.